Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Radio Mysterioso back, finally, after, what, 3 weeks? And putting off our guest about 3 weeks in a row, which we're going to make up for tonight, to you, to him, to everybody, to the universe. Our guest this week is John Shirley, famous to me and famous to a lot of other people, writer in the horror and cyberpunk tradition. John, would you say?
Yeah, well, it's come to a pretty pass when cyberpunk has become a tradition, but I'm afraid it's true.
Yeah, that's why.
John Shirley, you said?
Yes, John Shirley. That's your cowboy name.
I kind of prefer Shirley to Shirley.
I like Shirley. It sounds like it sounds like some sort of lawman.
John Shirley was a lawman. You say so.
That's what it sounded like to me. But the reason I was hesitant about that cyberpunk label is because you were writing this stuff before anybody called it that, and I guess it became sort of – it kind of took over and you really didn't have any control over it. You were just doing your thing.
I think so. I mean, it depends on how you define it and so on, but it was right from the beginning for me, it had a rock and roll street quality to it. And that sort of is the flavor of cyberpunk. You know, it became more and more sophisticated, as sort of like the way a souffle, you know, inflates and becomes all structured inside and full of little bubbles and things. And so there you get the souffle of William Gibson's writing. But I'm afraid I was just the little glop of dough at the beginning.
Yeah, but you're much. The dough has risen, has it not? I said the dough. But,
you know,
go ahead.
My early stuff had the same tenor and flavor, and some similar ideas, and it was all infused with all kinds of other. I was always influenced by countercultural sort of artists and. And people from, as early as Baudelaire and Rimbaud and then later William Burroughs. And I, think that those people are all kind of somewhere in the background of cyberpunk. It may seem hard to imagine because you think of it in this, schematic sort of computerized term, but terminology, but it... But really, it emerges from that kind of countercultural literary tradition and the sort of they're essentially cyberpunk writers are all bohemians, really all of them, Bruce Sterling and Lou Schreiner and Rucker and Gibson and.
Yeah.
And myself, we were just all instinctively bohemians. I mean, the first performance I ever did was at a show I started called the Dada Soiree.
Ah, where was that?
And it was about Dadaism, and we were all enthusiasts for Dadaism. We were influenced by Captain Beefheart and Frank Zappa, but also by Marcel Duchamp and Tristan Zara. And so, you know, and when you look at a lot of the essential cyberpunk, it's about, you know, people who are just taking the world as it exists and turning it on its head and kind of taking it over from, you know, a direction you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, well, also pointing out, as any good counterculture or bohemians would point out, that status quo is there's a fucked up sense to it, and you got to stand there and point it out as loudly as possible.
That's true. Well, I mean, you know, some people prefer an apolitical sort of point of view, but I'm just kind of innately political. I try not to be too polemical or didactic about it at all. But, you know, I have a point of view on the world, and it's really almost the same as the chivalric point of view. It has to do with the idea of protecting the weak from the exploitively strong, you know, the brutally strong. And that's somewhere in all of my writing, really. And it's too idealistic for a lot of, a lot of cyberpunk people like just to kind of, they're almost sort of Ayn Randian in their attitude of like individualism and man versus the state or something. But only, you know, it's all, their heroes are people, or they kind of romanticize, you know, I don't know, Al Capone or somebody. They romanticize people who are like some of the more creative criminals, you know, a lot of them. And you get this from Gibson. When you look at Gibson stuff, he always has people, who were on the shady side of things, but very creatively.
Yeah,
and
well,
they were actually heroes, and they were anti-heroes.
Yeah, you get that them, from...
And it was always... And so, you know, there's a specter within cyberpunk writing, I guess. William Gibson and, you know, nobody, it's just barely defined as a school of writing in some ways. On the other hand, you kind of know when you see it, you know. You see Blade Runner, you instantly think, well, that's it, you know. And Philip Dick, a lot of Philip Dick stuff. He was big influence on people.
Yeah.
Him and Samuel Delaney.
Who was the last one?
Samuel Delaney and Alfred Bester. And also John Brunner, the Shockwave writer, is the famous antecedent.
Okay, the last three names I haven't heard of, but I'm not...
You ever heard of John Brunner?
No.
Oh, well, he was a classic. He wrote The Sheep Look Up, which is a book that you should read. I mean, it's a...
I like the title.
Think of the title, you know, The Sheep Look Up. And it's it was about a world being destroyed by industrial civilization. It was a dramatization, a novelization of a lot of what is happening. If you look at the plastic vortex in the Pacific Ocean, and of course the BP oil spill, and the whole pattern of irresponsibility behind that. And lately, I don't know if you've seen the newest report that just came out about the acidification of the oceans. It's been a concern for a while, but now they're really getting worried about it. He said the carbon burden in the atmosphere is mixing with the oceans, increasing the pH to a remarkable degree, and the oceans are, they're not becoming battery acid, but they're becoming acidically dangerous and weird, and nobody's quite sure what the upshot's going to be. And then there's also another big methane bomb fear going on, having to do with a release of methane in various parts of the planet, partly due to global warming and partly due to the other just kind of the chemistry of what we're doing to the seas. And this methane will then, you know, increase the greenhouse effect exponentially. So it's not the end of the world, but it's a big damn mess, you know. And that was in The Sheep Look Up by John Brunner and The Stand on Zanzibar by him. And his Shockwave writer was also about Cybernetic. It was an early novel of cybernetic fiction of interconnected computers, and it anticipated a great deal. So it was a big influence. And Samuel Delaney wrote Nova, is one of his early novels about the synthesis of man and machine, and that is still a great book to rediscover. Nova, it's out there. Alfred Bester was a very bohemian guy, and he was a jazz fan, and his writing had an almost jazzy quality to it. It was almost like scatting or something. You know what I'm saying? In prose, and he never lost control of it. And he wrote some really powerful stuff that people have been borrowing from, like The Star Is My Destination, and The Demolished Man. And one of those was ripped off of that movie Jumper. They just borrowed the main premise of it to that movie, which they do all the time in making movies. They just steal science fiction premises.
Especially from people that are dead.
They did this kind of. They just take the ideas and a little bit of the story and just enough to get by without being sued.
Yeah, well, that's the way it's set up. You know, when you said that thing about anti-heroes and Al Capone and that influence, I think heavily of, like you said, William Burroughs and his favorite book, which was one of my favorite books when I read it, called "You Can't Win." You've read that, haven't you?
Is that about Dillinger?
No, it's by a guy.
He was big into Dillinger. He was a big fan of John Dillinger. I don't remember You Can't Win, though. I read, you know, the classic things by William Burroughs, like Ticket That Exploded and Naked Lunch and so on, and The Wild Boys.
I can see the influence in a lot of what you do. The point of You Can't Win was written by a career criminal. It was published in the 1920s, I believe. And the guy just wrote about growing up and becoming a criminal and having that be his career for the better part of his adult life. And then finally he reformed because they were going to throw him in jail again for like the 80th time. Anyway, it's just about living on the road and the criminal society and the code of honor among thieves.
And somebody like Burroughs, that's a kind of almost a revolutionary sort of thing. I mean, a lot of people sort of conflate, you know, the life and that kind of, as they call it, and that kind of life was being radical. And I know a guy, you know, has a long history in prisons who's an intellectual anarchist. And I don't recommend it as a course. I mean, it's like a mouse running through a gigantic machine full of gears that are turning.
Yeah.
And the mouse keeps sticking its tail in the gears to try and slow them down. I don't recommend it.
No, well, that's not the point of view of the guy in the book, and his name is Jack Black, by the way. I guess that's his pen name.
Oh, really?
But the point of the book is it's funny, he doesn't romanticize anything. He's pretty straightforward. He says, well, there's good parts of it. I met some good people, and eventually I found it. It was just too much for me, and I dug my own grave, and I had to dig myself out of it. That's the point of view of the book.
Well, that's a very, you know... That sounds like a lot of people's journey, really. I think that may have been my journey, in fact.
Yeah.
They just caught this kid, the Barefoot Bandit. Have you been following his story?
Sort of. I just read the tail end of it today in the L.A. Times.
People like William Gibson are really following his story. There's something very Gibson-esque about the guy. Or, I don't know, any number of modern writers are probably fascinated by it. People are sniffing around about the movie rights already.
Yeah,
and, you know, he is an extraordinary character. He's messed up. He started breaking into people's houses and stealing things and sort of using their house as his house when they weren't home when he was 12. But he just got more and more ingenious about it. And typically, he went barefoot, strangely enough. He had some trip about that, and when they caught him, he was barefoot.
Yeah.
And he used to leave chalk marks of bare feet on the floor of some buildings or some houses that he had gotten into.
How could that not be made?
Remarkable in that he kept was so amazingly elusive. This was up near the coast of Vancouver or Washington or something. He was amazingly elusive and tricky, and so they just couldn't catch him for a long time. He was really tricky and really creative about it. And you know what he did? Somehow, I don't know if it's from playing those video games where you fly or what, but he figured out the principles of flying, and he stole an airplane when he was pretty young, a teenager, and he flew it around and landed it. And he stole like a bunch of airplanes and landed them in different places. And as you know, before he was even 17, which is like that takes a lively intelligence to figure out how to fly an airplane and just kind of work it out and not crash it.
Yeah, all you know, I stole was a motorcycle by that.
And he recently stole one and flew it to the Bahamas, where he was running around for a long time loose. You know, breaking into things and stealing things. And there is something romantic about his character, just as there is about Jesse James. And
yeah.
Although often when you look closer at them, they are squalid. But I think the guy is probably, you know, had an awful childhood and was damaged. And but he has that lively intelligence and creativity, and it's enabling him to live a remarkable life. I'm against, you know, theft. When I was young, I was a pretty much a juvie kind of person. I was problematic to the law, but I got away with most of it. But later on, I decided on a different tactic, and I basically relate to the big machine. I try to relate to it intelligently and to make alterations and suggestions to it if I can. But I don't try to fight it anymore. And I feel that if you take like your average community, you know, people have to be protected from predation. You know. When I was in that life, I met a lot of sociopathic, twisted people and, a lot of damaged people. And there's so many of them out there and people have to be protected from them, but it's strange because they're victims too, but you have to protect people to prevent people from becoming victims of the victims.
Yeah, well, of course.
The point of all this ramble is that cyberpunk and kind of edgy science fiction, slipstream science fiction, kind of romanticizes the street side of things, or dramatizes it. And, if not romanticizes it. And that energy was there in my stuff early on. It always had that flavor. And I was influenced by noir writers, was one reason. But also, I just looked around. That was my world. And you find it in people like William Gibson and in some Neal Stephenson.
Anybody else?
Now, I've only interrupted you six times now. I don't know if I want to go for a seventh, but...
No, I keep saying things, but I think that I'm not coming through real clearly on your end, so I just let you talk, which is what I should do because you are the guest.
But, I like that concept.
Well, usually if somebody is going, sometimes people will call me up and say, why aren't you saying anything? I said, because the guest is doing fine and it's interesting. When it becomes not interesting, I'll interrupt.
You've always got plenty to say, though. You've got books out. We should both promote our books. What's the most recent book in print from Greg Bishop?
The most recent is Weird California, which came out like 5 years ago.
Even so, one can still get it on Amazon.
You can get it at the bookstore still. It's actually in print.
I've seen it. I saw it in a Barnes & Noble about 2 years ago. No, not even that much. About a year ago or less.
Yeah, it was out. It was
Weird
out
California,
front.
Greg Bishop, and since I expected you to send me a copy, I didn't buy one.
What? And, okay, I'll send you a copy.
And my newest book is Bleak History from Pocketbooks.
That must have been really recent because the last one I was aware of was The Other End, which is probably a year or more old now, right?
Oh yeah, it's about 2 years old. Bleak History is my most recent novel, and it came out months ago. And it's from Simon & Schuster pocketbook.
Good.
It's
we have kind of
urban fantasy exploration of metaphysical ideas, psychic adventure. It crosses a lot of boundaries and bridges.
Well, of course. There's two other books I notice in between Other End and this one. which I guess one of them is a work for hire alien steel egg.
Oh, I've written on a number of tie-in novels because, you know, they pay pretty well and they don't take very long. And besides, they're usually about something that's fun for me to write about. If I write about a Predators novel, well, I like the movie Predators, you know, so I wrote one.
Right.
I mean, they hired me to write one. You can't just write one on your own. And
obviously,
I wrote a novel about the game, the video game BioShock. That is kind of tells the backstory of BioShock, and BioShock's the pretty much the biggest game right now. One of two or three of the top games, anyway. I think it's coming out in January. So, and that was a lot of hard work. I had to play the game a bunch of times, but also I had to consult with the designers of the game, and then I had to take their notes and I had to, since it was the backstory of the game, I had to create a future. I had to sort of dramatize the history of it over a course of 15 or 20 years in the story. So doing that and knitting it all together is pretty tricky. But that'll be out from Tor Books later this year or early next year.
My novel,
Black Glass.
Oh, go ahead.
Came out, Black Glass, the lost cyberpunk novel, speaking of cyberpunk, and that came out from ESP, and it is, it's on Amazon and so on.
Type in John's name on Amazon.
It has an introduction that explains that it was originally devised as a plot by myself and William Gibson, and it was going to be a movie. And then somebody optioned it and it didn't happen. And then we started getting involved in other things, and it was rediscovered. And I turned it into a novel, and Gibson just turned it over to me. So it has some early Gibson flavor, but it's John Shirley stuff. I wrote the novel.
You know, John keeps saying these things.
Black Glass.
Go ahead.
Huh?
I was about to say, John keeps saying, talking about who he's worked with and what he's done, but most people, he flies under their radar, and he shouldn't, because I think the best thing he's known for, which I keep bringing up, which, what do you think it is, John?
The thing I'm most known for?
Yes.
Well, you work in the movie business. You probably think of The Crow.
Yes.
But, you know, that's because you live in Hollywood, and you work in the movie business, and you're just hopelessly, hypnotized by their glamour dust.
I am?
And, you're like this sleepwalking zombie in the thrall of the Hollywood overlord, so you can't help it. You can't help.
Yeah, I know. They pay my bills, so...
Because you have a job watching movies, right?
Yeah, which hypnotized me even further. And they pay me for it, which makes it even worse, John.
They put in these subliminal things in there to control your mind, and so that's pretty much all you can think about. But...
Are you mad because I put down a movie
I was involved with? I wrote the first four drafts of it, and I'm the co-screenwriter as it ended up. And it's a tragic thing because Brandon Lee died in the course of it, but they did make a good movie, and they're going to do a remake. Supposedly, they're shooting a remake in a couple of months. I don't know anything about it except that it's issuing from Sony, I think.
Uh-oh.
So I don't know. I don't know who the director is or anything. But
what's the track record of remakes? Not very good.
Well, this will be the exception, I'm sure, but I don't know.
Remakes or sequels or whatever. I don't know. I tend to think that most of them are pretty horrid. As an example, why did they make 2010? If there was never a 2001, 2010 would have been an okay, run-of-the-mill, fairly decent science fiction
movie. Well, I
thought
it was a pretty good sequel. It wasn't
really
as good as 2001, which was a masterpiece. I thought it was a good...
That's what I mean. If there was never a 2001...
I thought it was a well-made movie. But, I mean, 2001 was a masterpiece, so it kind of looked like a small monolith standing next to a giant one, but...
Well, that was my point. It's if there'd never been a 2001, 2010 would have been a fine little movie. It still is a fine little movie, but it's sitting right next to this incredible film that basically changed movies or changed the way some movies are made.
Some sequels are better. better than the first one. Evil Dead 2 is better than the first one. He had the money to make it. The Godfather 2 is at least as good as the first one.
True.
You know, there are examples. There are some.
I'm racking my brain to think of some. Yes, there are some.
There are some around somewhere.
Did you like the second?
True that they tend to be stepped down. There's a lot of claptrap comes out of the movie business. What was the famous Sturgeon's Law? You know, Sturgeon's Law.
95% of everything is crap.
Yeah, you hear different versions. I hear 9/10, 90%, 95, but that's the idea. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's some good stuff that comes out. But I mean, there was I just saw Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland on Netflix. I didn't go in the theater, and I'm glad I didn't. I wouldn't have wanted to spend money. I just was like, I feel that they must have hired him as a director for an existing script or concept or something. I can't see that it would have been his idea to make Alice in Wonderland into an action film with a lot of adventure movie cliches in it.
Yeah, there were. I mean, I didn't really horribly enjoy it either. And I like you mentioned before, I had to watch it about 20 or 30 times.
Oh, God, I pity you. Well,
yeah.
It's like, you know... it's like a mixture of The Wizard of Oz mixed with some Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Lord of the Rings, and the first Narnia movie. And there's almost no Alice in Wonderland in it. They used a few characters vaguely based in Alice in Wonderland, but the only one who seems sort of like it is the Red Queen. And it has nothing to do with the book. And they didn't advertise it that way to me. I mean, it's ridiculous. It has a plot. The book has no real plot. You know, it has a series of events, but the book is deliberately a nonsense novel. This movie makes a lot of, you know, thematic Hollywood type sense,
yeah,
which is too bad because it's a big cliche, and it's really an insult because the Mad Hatter is completely sane in it. I hate that. The Mad Hatter is supposed to be mad.
Yeah. It's
supposed to be crazy. This one's only mildly eccentric.
Well,
you
did
know,
you see?
That ain't right. You know what I'm saying? That's not right.
Well, I don't know what's going on with Burton.
It was terrible,
anyway.
And I liked his Willy Wonka version. I thought that was good. There's a remake I thought was good. His Willy Wonka. His Planet of the Apes, terrible, actually. Not very good, anyway.
Well, that seemed like
Willy Wonka,
a for hire, too.
Pretty cool. I liked it.
I didn't like it so much, but then there's that joke from South Park where they talk to Tim Burton. They say, why don't you just go ahead and marry Johnny Depp, for Christ's sake, make a movie that doesn't look like it's, you know, that isn't a rehash of everything that Tim Burton's done. He's kind of become a parody of himself.
I know. It's terrible.
Which is too bad.
But, you know, I'm hoping that Dark Shadows will be good. He's making Dark Shadows, which I did watch when I was a kid. And Johnny Depp watched it when he was a kid, and he thought he was Barnabas Collins, he said. And so he's like, he's going to play a character that he used to fantasize about being when he was a child. I don't know if you know what Dark Shadows is. You know,
yes, I do.
Gothic supernatural vampire soap opera from the 60s and
early
70s.
Yes, I know. I know, John. I've seen some of them.
Yeah. And a friend of mine was in it, Mitch Ryan. He was in it. He's in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Go ahead.
So, tell me this, Greg. Let me ask you an interview question.
Go ahead.
What thing in the world of the paranormal or the mysterioso world has excited you in recent years? Like in the last 2 years, what has there been that hasn't made you just kind of like, you know, like, oh, the same old, that it's like, you know, that could be this, that could be that. I mean, what has really juiced you up and say, ooh, that's intriguing?
That was a question
Anything?
I was going to have for you.
Huh?
That was a question I was going to have for you, but...
Well, for me, nothing. That's why I'm asking you. I haven't seen anything. Nothing has excited me in that respect.
Nothing excites me to the point where I think this is it, because there's no real way to prove a lot of these things the way we have rules for evidence set up right now. It has to change a little bit before we can examine some of these things on their own terms. So nothing really excites me. Might excite me personally, but that doesn't make any difference, because it has to excite a greater portion of the kind of people who think carefully about things, meaning scientists and policymakers and journalists and all that. So no, nothing really.
No, that's discouraging. I thought one of these days, you know, some mysterious guy is going to come to your doorstep and say, you know, I took a big chance stealing this from their files. Don't lose it. Don't tell anybody where you got it. Don't show it to anyone. Trust no one. And he's going to give it to you, and it's going to have like an old, you know, 8mm film in it, you know, of some crazy, you know,
of levitating,
you know,
discs
really convincing
being
looking, or perhaps ambiguously convincing looking. Alien UFO photography, and
well, then I guess it'll just,
and Aleister Crowley gets off the spaceship with the alien.
Yeah,
yeah.
The only thing I do,
and L. Ron Hubbard,
yeah,
gets off the spaceship with the aliens, and you recognize you recognize those guys on the 8mm tape.
And Jack Parsons too.
L. Ron Hubbard getting off and talking to the aliens and nodding their heads.
You forgot Jack Parsons, John.
And possibly Dick Cheney.
I don't know about that. That would be the reptilians, I think. He would be the one getting off the reptilian ship.
Yeah.
No, you know, if somebody handed me something like that, I think I'd have a really good basis to write my first fictional work.
You go for it. I mean, you know, isn't that basically how the so-called Majestic 12 papers came into distribution, somebody dropped them off on a doorstep or something?
They were delivered to the doorstep by the mailman, but then again, it didn't come with all the mail. To Jamie Chandray, the TV producer, and he showed it to his partner Bill Moore, and the rest is history. And now, before Bill Moore dropped out of the public eye and said, fuck it, screw all you people, he talked to me about it, and he said, at the time, I thought there was more validity to it. Now I think it's almost totally BS, which I would tend to agree with. And people are still arguing about it, which amazes me.
But who is the guy who some people have designated as the agent behind it, the disinformation agent? What was his name?
Doty, you mean?
Yeah, that was it. How do you spell it?
D-O-T-Y. I interviewed him for my book. I talked to him extensively.
Yeah, did he admit to it or hint at it?
No.
I'm sorry, I can't remember your.
That's
wrote.
Okay. It's not that fucking important. He didn't really admit to anything except with regards to that. He just said he knew where it came from, I believe, and that it wasn't him, which I don't believe at all. I think he had a hand in it, and knew exactly what was going on. I don't think he was.
But he had acknowledged that it was not actual.
No,
not
he didn't.
Real.
No, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't. Okay.
No, he. I don't know if he insisted it was real. He was cagey about it, but he said that as far as he knew, that stuff in it was real, which I know he knows for a fact is not true.
Yeah.
So the guy, it's people actually. They would ask me, why do you talk to these people? They're lying through their teeth. They're screwing with people. And I said, that's why I talk to them, because it's fun.
Yeah.
It's a game.
Also, it's also an insight into. Well, impossible insight anyway. For example, if Doty was and Doty or Doji? Doty, right?
D-O-T-Y.
Doji, that's it. If he was an intelligence agent, if he was working, or if he was working in a psychological operations, well, it kind of gives an insight into, you know, those people and what they're like. And it's a little tiny crack, into that, through the wall of that world. You know what I'm saying?
You know what's interesting? You say that. After I finished that book and finished talking to all those government people and agents and people from Air Force Intelligence, CIA, NSA-type people, then the movie, what was the Chuck Barris book? Confessions of a Dangerous Mind came out. And people think he made up that story and he had nothing to do with the CIA. You know about that story, right? Okay, George Clooney produced and co-starred. Sam Rockwell played Chuck Barris. Chuck Barris, the TV game show guy.
Right.
He wrote an autobiography called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, in which he said that he was trained to kill by the CIA and would run off to countries during dating game trips and kill people and neutralize spies while chaperoning dating game people, and then come back to this country and continue his show.
I heard about this movie. Is it a cool movie?
Yes, I enjoyed it a lot, and I'm fairly certain you would. It's an overlooked movie.
I have heard about it. I've been wanting to see it, and I forgot about it. Now I want to see it. And he was crazy, though, right, this guy?
Chuck Barris?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think he was one of those high-functioning crazy people. The point of the movie was in the book that after reading it, I looked at it and watched the movie, and I get the distinct feeling that he did have contact with some people in the agency, because a lot of the stuff he talked about is not generally brought into books and movies about spy stuff. It's actually fairly real, the way he describes people and situations.
Find out these things. He also could have had a brush with intelligence.
No, I didn't say. Yeah.
And then left it and imagined the rest. They might have kicked him out because he was crazy.
Yeah, well, I didn't say that he did.
Other explanation.
I didn't say that he did the things he said he did. What I said was that he knew somebody who did, at the very least. And that makes it interesting to me. I mean, I like that game. I like the spy game. I like people trying to screw with each other, and trying to see through different lies to whatever little kernel of truth is there, and where that leads you. That fascinates me.
Well, what about the Man Who Stared at Goats? The Man Who Stared at Goats.
Yeah, that one came out recently. That was based on the John Ronson book, Men Who Stare at Goats. Which did you read it?
No, I haven't seen the movie either. I read articles about it and reviews, and I'd like to see it. I just didn't get to it.
I think you'd like it.
Did you see it?
I didn't see it, but I think you'd like it, and I think you'd like the book, because basically it said the whole remote viewing program and all that stuff was a big failure, and it was totally stupid and a waste of time.
Well, that's what I think anyway, as you know. I mean, I think that I knew some one person who was sort of involved with that. Cat name, I think it was Eagle Burger.
Don't know that
and,
name.
And some other people. I've met people involved in it, and they all say, there was a little bit of success, kind of. And then they got all excited about that, and they just kept getting funding, and then nothing else really worked. There was one event that was sort of a remote viewing of, where was it, Honduras, an event in Honduras, and it seemed to confirm there was something there. But essentially, with that kind of phenomena, If to the extent it exists, it's really pretty impossible to control. It's for many. We don't understand it well enough to control it.
Right.
You know, we get how radio waves work, but this other thing is like, you know, it's just too. There's a reason they call them wild talents.
Yeah.
Right. You remember that expression? Well, that's because to the extent they exist. I say again. The reason they're wild talents is because you can't really domesticate them.
Yeah,
they you know, have their own timing and you know, it's just not something you could use in any kind of formatted context anyway. And plus, which 99% of the people who claim to have these abilities are liars. You know, I mean, people like John Edwards, not the senator, John Edwards.
I know what you're talking about.
The so-called medium is just a guy who uses cold readings, and he's a liar and a crook.
I would agree with you on that.
The opinions expressed by guests on the show are not necessarily those of Radio Mysterioso.
Well, I agree with you on John Edwards. I think he's a lying charlatan. I agree with you.
But, you know, they this the old spoon bender.
We got in a big argument about him. We got in a large argument about him a few years back. I remember
the old spoon bender.
Yes,
The old spoon Bender is just another. You know, he was proven to be, you know, fraudulent, in my opinion. I don't think there's anything to that guy. But it happens that I think that there is some, not supernatural, but telepathic phenomena and precognitive phenomena that exists. Happens, I think there is some.
Oh, that's funny. That's a change for you.
But, you know, in the Tao Te Ching, they say, those who say don't know, and those who know don't say.
Really? I thought bikers said that.
Bikers took it from an old Chinese saying,
right?
And which they probably got from a fortune cookie. But it came from Lao Tzu.
It came from Bob Dobbs, actually.
It's in the Tao Te Ching, thousands of years old. And bikers do say that, yeah. But they're talking about something different.
And the subgeniuses say it, too, which, of course, is they say everything.
Who says it?
The subgenius people say it,
oh,
too.
Yeah. Well, the Lao Tzu said it, it's very true. If there's a psychic who says they're a psychic, they're not a psychic. Let's put it that way. They're probably a would-be cult leader or a con artist. Like this person, these people, this woman behind the What the Bleep movie. Have you seen that?
No, I heard the whole thing about it, and I just had no interest whatsoever in seeing it because it seemed like a self-deception, and at best a con.
Well, the woman behind it calls herself Ramtha.
It was the Ramtha people.
She, you know, she's a cult leader. And so they designed the movie so that it seems like she's just one person they talk to. But in fact, the whole thing is funded by her trip, by her people. And it's really, it gave her a big infusion of money. That thing made tens of millions of dollars. It had like a budget of $50,000 and it made millions and millions of bucks. I mean, they really, you wouldn't believe it. I know some people who are, I know a guy who's basically, the manager of the director of that film. And it made upwards of $100 million. And it cost about $200,000.
Yeah. Well, and also the Ramtha people have some vaguely but fairly dangerous racial views, I think.
Oh, yeah. What was it? Was it anti-Semitism or black people are from outer space or what is it?
I think it's more in the
Ant or Jews or reptoid aliens. I've heard that one too.
Yeah, something. No, that's I think what's his name? David. What's that idiot's name? The race car driver.
Oh, David Icke.
Yeah, David Icke.
David Icke. David
yeah.
Icke.
Yeah, I can't remember what the Ramtha people are, and I don't want to accuse them anymore when I can't even remember exactly what it was. But they were channeling some basically white supremacy stuff.
Oh yeah, well that woman is a crazy paranoid. She also has a compound. She's one of the people with a compound.
Oh, I knew
she
they had a compound.
Big, she dug a big underground complex, and kept predicting the end of the world that never came, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, the Scientologists have that huge one in New Mexico that has that big symbol burned into the ground above it. You heard about that, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, that's
yes,
a little frightening.
Yes, all the money that's wasted in silly ass stuff like that.
Yeah, that's depressing. Like, really? It's almost depressing. I don't know what's more useless, monuments erected to people and things or that kind of stuff. I really don't know. Money that could be used. There's a huge firefighters
kind of
monument down the street.
You know, it's bigger in scale. It wastes more money. It's sad. It's sad how much. It's time to tax the churches.
Well, you know what? You put that up on Facebook.
Tax the churches.
You put that up on Facebook.
Scale,
I don't agree with
like
you.
Like if it's that, like it's just a little, a little epic church in South Central, and they're barely struggling. You don't charge them any tax or barely any, if any. Because you do it on a sliding scale. But the bigger the church is, the more you charge. You take a lot of money from the Scientologists, Catholics, and those blood-sucking televangelists.
Hey, John, I would like to agree with you because I would like revenge on all those assholes that take people's money. But I can't because why would you give somebody like that, a big church with a lot of money, even more political influence than they have now? Because they're going to figure that it's their right, and it would be if they had to pay taxes.
Well, people, they do have some influence anyway. They just do it through intermediaries.
Yeah, but
make it part of the legislation that, by the way, you can't have any influence because we have a separation of church and state. But then since you're a business, you can't, you have to pay taxes. And they'll say, but that's not fair. We'll say, tough. That's my plan. Tax the churches. Well, and then we would not have all this problem in California with, you know, with the budget and so on. We would tax the churches, and that will pay for our budgetary impasse. It'll take it back.
Well, see, there's another thing that we've discussed that we disagree on. I think that the same exact budget hole could be fixed by legalizing drugs, or at least some of them.
Well, marijuana. You can legalize marijuana. I don't care. You could have some kind of limited legalization of shrooms, I suppose, if you do it in...
That's not the cash crop, though.
They issue that stuff, but it can be awfully strong, but... there should be some limited legalization, and marijuana should be legalized. Let's grow up about it. I mean, it's silly. You know, it's like prohibition. And we could use the revenue. And I don't think if there's a person who's drunk and a person who smoked the joint, and somebody asked me which one should drive the car, the guy who should smoke the joint would be a little safer.
They drive a lot slower.
They're not the ideal drivers either. Their judgment is a little impaired. But compared to a drunk, I'd have the pothead drive.
Yeah, well, the pothead, if you get in an accident, you're going 5 miles an hour, so.
Well, that's often the case, that's often the case. I cannot see legalizing drugs like cocaine and meth. The more access people have to them, and I do believe that if you could buy it in the local grocery store, that's more access, or the local pharmacy or something, then, you know, the more paranoid, psychotic people there'll be, the more people who, you know, ignore their children all day and, you know, and drive under the influence of this shit. And there's a lot of this stuff around, but I really think there would be even more of it around if you legalize meth and cocaine.
Meth is some dangerous stuff. I mean, there was a book recently. I can't remember the name of it. My wife turned me on to it. It was just about a little town in the Midwest that was basically ruined by meth. And it's, you know, happened over and over and over again because there's nothing to do, no jobs, nobody can get out of there. So what are they going to do? What happens when people get bored? They get high and do evil stuff.
Yeah. They prey on one another and they do a lot of random stuff, and that doesn't work out either. They neglect their children, and that causes a lot of problems. They pollute local streams, or burn things down. The economy falls apart. Nobody works. Everything's inefficient. It just gets worse and worse. Meth has destroyed a lot of small communities.
And
in fact, it's affected people in my family, not my direct family, but other people, you know, people in my extended family deeply. And I've seen the damage that is done by it firsthand. So, you know, if there's an alien plot, it was introducing drugs like that. That would have been my first move for a long term attack on Earth. Introducing widespread use of meth and cocaine and so on. But in fact, they say that soma, which was used thousands of years ago, was made partly from ephedra.
Oh, really? There's different ideas about that.
And a variation of marijuana. It may sometimes, some formulas of it in northern India, places like that, may have had opiates, you know, opium. Ephedra is like an herb. Obviously, it goes into ephedrine, which then becomes methadrine later.
Yes.
Uses, like stimulants like that were used for, you know, and thousands of years. So the aliens started early on that plot.
Well, there's a Terrence McKenna idea that the aliens came by and left mushroom spores. And that's one of the ideas about...
Oh, yeah, he thinks it was a gift, probably.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wouldn't argue with him.
That's the kind of thing people think when they get high. See, I just play with ideas. I don't believe that stuff. I know the aliens are out there. I just doubt we're going to meet them anytime soon, but...
What do you mean you know the aliens are out there? You mean in the way that...
I feel like Stephen Hawking, you know, to me it's like a coin toss, whether or not it's dangerous to encounter them. Or, you know, they could just... I mean, we could get the settlers versus the Indian thing, you know.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they could be reasonably benevolent. It's 50-50, and, you know, they could easily be just, essentially disregarded as vermin.
Well, my idea recently, well, the past few years has been whatever it is would be so alien to us, there wouldn't be a whole hell of a lot of interface except for on some maybe inscrutable symbolic level, if that makes any sense.
It's possible. I mean, they could be as different from us as jellyfish are, except with intelligence and more, you know, with technology, presumably.
Or octopi.
They could be that different from us, you know, or insectial or something.
Yeah.
It's quite possible, I suppose. I mean, a lot of people think that the claim that the logical format for a race that becomes civilized and moves to the stars is a bipedal race with eyes more or less like us, kind of on our model. But that could be just the interpretation of anthropomorphization. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That could be just vanity and finding rationale for that.
Yeah, we're making aliens in our own image.
Yeah, it could easily be. Like Larry Niven had those. Those aliens that were like looked like they were like three-legged things or something, and they looked and they were traders. I mean, they went about trading and they were kind of sharp merchants. But they looked, you know, they had, as I recall, they had three legs and they were just really grotesque.
Well,
they looked like amalgams of, you know, locusts and three-legged horses or something.
Well, Jesus, the old Star Trek TV show, that aliens ran the gamut from humanoid to big blobs with hair sticking out of them. But, you know, they always come down to a biologically based thing that has a consciousness.
I don't know. They could be, by the time they get to us, they could be... indistinguishable from their own mechanisms. I mean, they could have like been basically become so cyborgian we wouldn't know them from machines. They could we may be exposed to them for 100 years before we figure out they're artificial organisms that were created by another race entirely. We haven't been informed about because better we don't know about them. I mean, we really don't.
I get
They're going to be way in advance of us, they may appear to us as globes, and then it may be 300 years before we see what's in the globe.
Well, I've been playing with an idea for a while, and it actually came from Leonard Nimoy. They asked him when he was touring for the Star Trek movie that he directed with the whales in it.
Yeah.
So one of the journalists... And a friend of mine was at this conference, I mean, this press conference. One of the journalists said, well, do you think the whales are ahead of us or behind us or what? And he said, Nimoy says, I tend to think of them as off to the side somewhere, neither behind nor ahead. And that's how I've kind of taken that as a touchstone comment about alien stuff. The one that I like to entertain the most, they're kind of off to the side somewhere in a way that might appear ahead of us, I suppose, but maybe just more versed in certain arts,
If that's quite possible.
Yeah, it's quite possible. It'd be funny if they were like really good at interplanetary travel and a few other things, and then were like, you know, they had all kinds of ridiculous superstitions and were super primitive medievalist type thinkers or something. And, you know,
there's a book.
They talk about do not place a curse upon me, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, what? You know, they could be ridiculous. They could be emotionally immature or something, you know.
And yeah, they don't get what they want, they throw tantrums.
Equivalent of weeping, you know, at the slightest appearance of disrespect. And
yeah, well, you don't want them throwing tantrums.
I want to talk to you.
Yeah. Are you folding your arms at me? Yeah.
Yeah, that's another problem. You don't know when you're committing a solecism.
We're venturing into Douglas Adams' Red Dwarf kind of territory here, I think.
I suppose it is. I like Red Dwarf, and I like Douglas Adams. I interviewed Douglas Adams
really
for a magazine, and my interview with him, I think, was incorporated into an article I wrote that is Douglas Adams and the Wisdom of Madness, which is at the John Shirley website, which is darkecho.com/John Shirley, or just Google John Shirley. There's a lot of nonfiction there, and I write my ideas about UFOs. They're kind of outdated at this point, I suppose. I haven't kept up the last few years, but my general point of view on it.
What is your general point of view?
Psychological stuff like what was that? When they were running tapes backwards and...
Backwards masking.
Yes, and all that stuff, you know, and hearing messages in them, and that was a thing for a while, and then people realized it was bullshit, and it kind of faded. But and do you remember Rods, R-O-D-S?
Yes, I do remember that. And I...
they had the mysterious rods, which were, they had all this photography of what are they? What are rods? And then they eventually been, well, actually, it's kind of a blurry picture of a bug that we have around here.
No, a lot of people still believe rods are some undiscovered, weird kind of entity, even when you prove to them over and over again that it's bugs.
I know. It's just like crop circles. You can say, okay, here's the guy who made all the first 200 crop circles that you have in your book on crop circles, and he says, I made it this way, and here's a picture of me making it, here's a video of us making it, you know, and here's the computer program we used to model it, and the people say, yeah, but those first 200 didn't count. 201 was real, man. And that was made by my friend Larry. 202 was...
I don't smirk as hard as you on the crop circle thing.
I remember, but they were calling themselves seriologists.
Yes, they still do. I don't smirk as hard as you on the crop circle thing because I know people that make them.
Yeah.
And a couple of them say not all of them are made by at least people with boards. And some of them say, which is more interesting, that when they're making the circles, weird stuff happens to them while they're making the circles. Now, they lying to
me. What kind of weird stuff?
Disorientation, lights shining and flying around, just weird things. And not, they'd say, well, we made the circle, but it's somehow we woke something up and we don't know what it is. And a couple of people say that they make the circles, but there's something directing them to do so. Now, I don't know if these people are insane or what.
They could be people just promoting their little trip, too.
Yeah, or that, too. But then they're there.
And some of them could be crazy and so on. I don't think there's anything to crop circles. I'm all ready to see an alien spacecraft. I just need to see it land on the White House lawn. I need to have reputable scientists go through it.
That's never going to happen. John, that's never going
to
happen.
Even if I saw something that appeared to be an alien spacecraft landing and glowing somewhere, I'd still be suspicious. Because still be greater that it was either an unknown craft built on Earth by some, you know, an experimental craft, or a setup. You know, and Jacques Vallée talked about how he talked to you to French Secret Service guys who admitted faking UFO abductions, alien abduction.
I don't remember him doing that. I remember him.
Yes, he did say that. I can't quote which book it was, but he did say that.
I wouldn't doubt it. I can't remember which book it was in. I remember one case where a guy said he was abducted and he disappeared for a few weeks, and then later they found it. He had, under some horrible questioning, he admitted that it was a big hoax. After the news and a bunch of believers and everybody said it was one of the most real abduction things they'd ever heard of, and it was like Francis Travis Walton or whatever.
It was in France?
It was in France, yeah.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about that. People want to believe, just like in the it says on the X-File poster.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people that want to believe.
I think we've discussed my ideas on why that is before. Basically, people crave transcendence of different kind. The kind of, and then there's the union impulse for projecting things into the sky.
There's that. I think, and my interest still comes because of what we talked about at the beginning of the show, that some of these things, whatever they may be, ghosts or ESP or paranormal, whatever, in that category, if real, which I think some of them are real in a sense that it's not just things that we've misperceiving, then it kind of thumbs its nose at people who say they know everything.
Well, maybe so. I always liked that alien that used to appear in UFO reports who wore a cowboy hat and smoked a cigarette.
He did?
Remember that one?
Oh, it sounds like something Streber might have talked about.
I can't remember from a Streber. Oh, I apparently more than one UFO report close encounter report described this person, and one person might have picked it up from somebody else and then just made it and put it in their story. But I just like the idea of it. You know what I saw recently, again, for the first time since the theater, totally worth seeing in this area, is the Mothman Prophecies.
Really? Because I never saw the end of that. My girlfriend had a health emergency right in the middle of it. I never saw the whole thing.
Well, you can rent it. Hello,
yeah.
Netflix.
Yeah, of course I can rent it. I just haven't done it yet.
I mean, all you do is watch movies all day over and over. Why wouldn't you want to watch a movie?
Well, there's your answer, yeah.
But nevertheless, it's one, you should see it. I mean, if you're going to be Radio Mysterioso, you got to see this picture. Because
why did you like it?
It's the best movie about kind of like recreating what has supposedly happened in a paranormal way that I ever saw that I think. I think it's the best one I've seen. I don't know how real any of those events were. I personally doubt, it happened like that. But it's just
It didn't, but that doesn't matter.
It's really well done. It just puts you in that frame of mind, and you just feel like, yeah, that could happen. And, you believe in it while you're watching it. Really, it's really well directed, and the editing is just incredible.
You know what? I did see the rest of it. I saw it when I was doing some I was doing surveillance training down in San Diego when I didn't have a job, and we actually sat down and watched that movie, not as part of the surveillance training, but I saw the rest of it, but not quite to the end because I think I went to sleep. My favorite part of the movie, though, is when he goes and talks to that guy that's named John something, which is supposed to be sort of an amalgam of John Keel and some other people. Or no, John is his name in the movie, right?
Right,
Gear's name.
But it's John Klein.
That's it,
and
Klein.
And I think John Klein, and played by Richard Gere. And, he's supposed to be John Keel, essentially.
Yeah.
And then there's another character who plays another aspect of John Keel
right.
or something. And
exactly, he goes to talk to him.
It's really weird and eerie. It's very eerily done. And it's not like a big monster movie.
Yeah.
It's much eerier than that.
It's a kind of a
and it's it's the kind of thing that you could almost believe in more than that you can believe in other stuff of that nature because it's so close to the border of conventional experience. It's just right on the other side of the border.
Yeah, you mentioned that movie and how they don't really show anything. It kind of has that Jacques Tourneur cat people kind of thing. Where you don't actually ever see
that a lot. That's right.
thing that's going
and
on.
And, of course, it's based on John Keel's work to some extent. He died a year ago, right? Did you ever meet him?
Yes, a few times. I've got books signed by him.
Well, so how did he impress you?
He impressed me as a guy that didn't really take anything too horribly seriously.
I always suspected.
Also, exceedingly curmudgeonly with people he didn't have any time for, which I thought was hilarious. And also quite willing to talk to me and hang out with me for a while and talk to whatever I wanted to talk to him about, which I, you know, I don't. When I first met you, I felt the same way. It's like, what the hell does he even want to talk to me about? This guy has actually accomplished something.
Keel probably, you know, he saw that you were one of the bright ones and you had more than one point of view or the capability of seeing different points of view. And a lot of these guys interested in this stuff are very fixated and narrow and they're caught up in their little trips. So,
I guess
you know,
so, but
you,
the funny thing is he part of it.
A smart guy with a flexible mind is a relief for someone like John Keel, I think.
Maybe so. The funny thing is that he partially was responsible for making me that way.
Oh, well, yeah, because he always was a bit of a rogue in the old paranormal area, you know?
Yeah, even if I don't.
He was the first guy who to suggest a connection between elf stories and gray aliens, right?
That might have been Valet.
I think this was before Valet.
Really?
Because Keel goes way back.
Yeah,
he
but we didn't.
Way,
we
he
didn't
was
have the
for Fate magazine when I was
right.
a little kid.
Yeah, but we didn't have the gray alien meme until possibly the mid to late 70s.
Well, we talked about little green men, though. Little small aliens were a thing.
Yeah.
And
but that's a cultural meme from back from the 30s or before that.
Yeah, for some odd reason. And he made a lot of those connections that I don't know if there's anything to those connections, but it's very creative of him. And once he did that, he was able to play with that a lot. And I think his big influence was probably Charles Fort, because Charles Fort was always looking for some really curious explanation for these things that you wouldn't normally go to, like. Not just aliens, you know. This idea that our world might be a sort of amusement park for
yes.
creatures from another dimension or something.
Yeah, that was one of his ideas. The other that's what the cool thing about Ford is he would speculate, but he wouldn't stick to an idea. And you mentioned Wild Talents earlier. That was I think that probably came from him because that was the title of one of his books.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's another, you know, heavy influence. You start reading, if anybody has not read Charles Fort, and it's like reading one of your novels or one of just one of those people that when you start reading their stuff, your mind kind of switches over to their point of view and their way of looking at things, and you're kind of enthralled by it for a while. And when you come out of it, you're kind of disoriented for a little bit. Because there's some writers that can do that, and Fort's really good at that.
That's true. I mean, he breaks up your, your old models and your old molds of thinking, and suddenly you've got to find a new point of orientation, and he opens up all these doors of possibilities, and at the very least, people like that are super useful for. Fiction writers.
Yeah.
I was saying about the Mac Toney's book, Crypto Terrestrials.
Yes.
That he was going to be borrowed from by shows like Fringe.
Yeah.
And that kind of show and movie producers and people are going to swipe ideas from him. And he was using John Keel's ideas and some of Charles Fort, but he was also bringing in some of his own and some of his own research. I really wish he had taken the book all the way before he passed on.
Yeah, well, me too. We were talking. I think I told you this. We were talking about collaborating on a fiction book because he was a good fiction writer, and I've not written any fiction. But we used to have long conversations, and finally, about 2 months before he died, I said, "Hey, Mac, why don't we just write a book incorporating all these weird ass ideas that we're always talking about in a way that's like a sweeter pill to swallow for people to kind of start swishing these concepts around in their mind about." Ultra-terrestrials or crypto-terrestrials or, you know, the weirdness associated with an encounter with a so-called UFO and what happens to people's lives and how it affects their consciousness and the local environment and other people. Just all this stuff. I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could put this all in one book? And he said, great idea. And we started working on it, and then he wasn't around.
It's kind of like something Robert Anton Wilson would have dug.
Yeah, which is another, as you know, another huge influence on me when in my thinking, and as well as Kiel, about being open to many interpretations and many models and not being stuck on any of them.
Right, and you should write the book. You should just write it. You should write it and dedicate it to Mac, Tony's. But he was a good writer. I read his articles and I read his Mars book and I read the Crypto Terrestrials. I thought he had a good ear for writing. He could write a good sentence.
It's funny.
You can't really say that about everybody writing in that field.
Yeah, that's one thing I admired about him is that he could take a complicated concept and not really simplify it, but evoke it in a way that was writerly and clear, which is very rare.
Are you on a cell phone?
No, but you are.
No, I'm not.
Well,
I'm
you're on
a house phone.
You're coming.
House phone.
You're coming through You're coming through my cell phone. Why?
I'm coming through your cell phone?
Yeah, that's the only way I can do it in the studio without having the guests call in.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, I just have it on speakerphone, and I mic it.
Well, hopefully people out in the cybernetic web world can hear us both better than we can hear each other.
I can hear you fine. Can you not hear me too well?
You keep kind of cutting out, but on the other hand, I think that's just, you know, the government monitoring devices that are, you know, creating some interference.
Well, when they do that, they actually pull part of the signal away, and sometimes the cell signal can't.
I don't have to bother to listen to us. I've met so many schizophrenics who explain to me patiently why, you know, and there's some guy who's like living in an alley, and yeah, the government's watching me. They know, you know, they send agents, or like they would spend money on you, you know, but they, you know, on the other hand, there is a lot of surveillance going on. There is what's the name of the one that's, there's a term for it. I've forgotten it now. The one that scans emails just for keywords.
Oh, Promise software?
It's a kind of software. It's like, software that scans millions of emails. And
yeah.
It's used. They use it.
It's not a
paranoid fantasy. And, you know, I mean, it's just stuff like, I have the bomb prepared. That means, you know, it'll stop on that email, you know.
Promise is part of it, PROMIS, which Ken Thomas wrote about extensively. But there's other algorithms and programs that the NSA uses to scan. Yeah, millions of emails, phone calls.
I think it is the NSA, yeah. You know, I've got mixed feelings about it, but I was thinking about this recently, what would be what's so much really the downside of that? Is it really going to turn into 1984 because of surveillance? And is it really? We already have so much in our society anyway, but...
Yeah, don't be scared of the government. Be scared of people who want your money.
It's going to be on your money? It's on your money?
No, I said don't be scared of the government with regards to Big Brother stuff. It's going to be for people who want your money.
Well, they want your money. Yeah, that's true.
Marketing
people. That's what's happening all the time. You know, Facebook is is watching us and recording information as we interact with people, and then it sells that information to people.
Yeah.
I don't really care that much about that stuff. It's irritating. But the only reason I can think of to really worry about the government surveillance of me, since I don't break any laws anymore, is that if suppose it becomes necessary to have a real rebellion of some kind, suppose there's a 7 days in May kind of Pentagon takeover of the government, and they there's a coup, and the general takes over, and they put Obama in jail, and it's not unthinkable. If something like that happened, then I would look for the underground and join them. And then, because I had been fine with all this surveillance before, suddenly it's used against me. When suddenly it becomes, suddenly it matters, you know. But that's the only scenario in which I would really give a good goddamn. Actually, I don't really care if they hear me. If I ever have phone sex, I never have. But if I did, I wouldn't care if they listened. What if I care?
Oh, I wouldn't care. The funny thing is that I met this guy who was in or had new people that were in an intelligence capacity, and he scared the crap out of me. And I started thinking there were people listening to my phone calls and taking pictures of my house and opening my mail. Actually, they were opening my mail. That was pretty obvious.
Why would they? Because you had been talking to intelligence people?
No, this is before that.
What is this?
Well, the thing, when I get every letter I get from one abduction researcher and a cattle mutilation guy has been either destroyed, opened, and resealed, or lost, every single one, you start to wonder. Because you get ads or you get letters from friends.
Well, the cattle mutilation guys, I can believe it. The cattle mutilation scene, it seems to me that there were some cattle mutilation patterns, and then it seems to me we've discussed this before, but it was related to secret military programs, and so I could kind of believe it, actually.
Or disease monitoring.
I could believe it's possible that they might, but on that one, anyhow. I mean, it's an unhealthy thing to imagine that they're watching you all the time, because mostly they're not. Mostly they have bigger fish to fry.
Right, exactly.
But if you were getting information from people who were getting too close to the government programs like, biological warfare programs, that involved the apparent cattle mutilation patterns, and it's possible.
Yeah, it is possible, of course. The point was that after about a year of this incredible paranoia, I got tired of it and stopped feeling that way, and the paranoia magically went away. And I got to the point where I thought, well, who cares? I'm still here. Nobody's dragging me off anywhere. I'm still functioning the way I used to function, so why be paranoid?
It depends on what you meddle in. You know, if there were a couple of guys who were pretty close to proving that electronic votes were stolen electronically. We may have discussed this last time. I was talking to somebody about it, and both of those guys mysteriously committed suicide. One of them by shooting himself in the head twice.
Yeah.
That was a guy in San Jose who was also the same cat who did that series of exposés about the CIA involvement in cocaine dealing.
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about, yeah. And I can't think of his name.
That same guy was found dead. He said he was telling people that somebody's been, observing my house, and there was somebody who was, these guys were hanging around and watching him, and then the next day he was dead. And they said
Gary Webb
shot himself in the head twice.
Gary Webb.
And he said that he was close to information about how votes were being stolen and by the GOP bunch and the Karl Rove syndicate, so to say, the machine. And then the other guy was the one who was the I think up on the Great Lakes area, who was a computer technician who was apparently involved in helping do this stuff and was going to give evidence against Rove and some other people in a deposition, basically indicating, yes, there had been electronic vote stealing in the Ohio 2004 election.
Yep.
Stealing it from Kerry. That guy's plane crashed, and he was in a small plane, and it crashed.
It makes you wonder, though, because the other person that's been doing this and hounding that subject of vote stealing is Greg Palast, and he continues to maintain that nobody's ever threatened him at all, which makes you wonder about his information.
he may be too high profile. It could be a lot of reasons, but then you can talk about the subject, but if it's when you get specific evidence
that could be used really
to bring specific people down that you become dangerous if the scenario is as real as it seems.
Well, from what he's written, Palast has
just mostly done things by inference, and he's talked to people who know about some, but nothing that could be, that is really substantial enough to be a threat. To those people.
Well, I would say that he has found substantial stuff, but by your argument, if nobody's really bothered him and he doesn't feel threatened, then maybe he's not saying anything.
It's not
that's
enough.
Actionable.
He hasn't got enough. But these other people were too close to something. But we don't know what.
Now you're starting to sound like a conspiracy person,
who was,
John.
In Florida, who was had found out that about some vote tampering in Florida. In a key county, and he called his wife from a motel, and I really should have these people's names, but it's been a couple of years since I was following this. He called his wife and said he was really excited about this story. He was a journalist. He was going to break this. It's going to be great. And then he was found the next day dead of an apparent suicide in his motel room, the very motel room he had called her excitedly from the night before.
Yeah, people get suicided occasionally.
It seems to be. In that case, it was really... His wife insisted that he was not suicidal, and there was no reason to believe he was going to kill himself or would want to. But strangely enough, there were reports of a couple of guys who went into his room earlier that day, and those three deaths were all on the same page in a way. They were all about the same kind of, they all had the same background of vote tampering,
right?
Relating to a particularly. Ruthless regime in the United States. Regime is perhaps not the word, but ruthless political machine, involving people like Karl Rove and Dick Cheney. And you can say Bush, but personally I think Bush was just, dancing on their strings.
Well, he was, I think for the most of the people listening to this show and you and I, it was more like this is the person that we can use as the our beard or whatever for a while, because we can operate under that umbrella out of the White House. And
I think it was kind of the case with Bush. I mean, people were manipulating him, and I like the movie W.
That was a funny movie. Scary.
The Oliver Stone film. I thought it was, it doesn't really get that far into it, but it kind of shows him as being this guy who is, sort of floundered into this, and it's almost sympathetic to him.
Yeah, and
just a kind of a survivor in this world that he had grown up in a way, yeah. and lived in all his life.
What's funny is the new Oliver Stone film is apparently a travelogue of South America. That's what it looks like from the ads. Which is the great unfinished Orson Welles film was exactly the same thing. Called, what was that film called?
It's all
true. Well, I think it's a political travelogue, this Oliver Stone thing. And
is it?
And it's about all these alternative societies down there, or these governments that are being painted one way in our country, and he goes down and looks at them in a fresher way and sees that they're really, you know, not a bunch of crazy leftist, hardcore, you know, communist people or something. They're just...
Okay, then you know a little bit more about it than I do.
They're relatively mild, and he says that a lot of lies are being told about Chavez and Venezuela. And,
right, because he's not playing ball.
Yeah.
He's not playing ball with the oil.
So he seems blandered, suppose. This is all what Oliver Stone says. I haven't seen the film. I don't know. I'm no big fan of communists, but these people don't seem to be. They're just willing to have a certain, like, mild level of nationalization, and then everybody gets all upset. Strange.
Well, they get upset because they are being told to be upset by people that don't like that kind of thing because they want to make more money.
Well, you know, we have a history of CIA involvement in overthrowing places like, you know, the democratically elected original government in Guatemala and in Iran. That's how we ended up with these creeps that run Iran now, is because there was a relatively progressive government there, and then we overthrew them with the CIA and installed the Shah.
Yeah,
and
so then that a reaction
led to
that.
Such a reaction that it brought in the Islamists and the hardliners, and, you know, we just made a mess of that country.
Well, it's happened over and over, because there's a lot of short-sightedness, I think, and what's the word? The thinking that the one way is the right way, and that's our way, and we don't want to consider what's going on locally and how that might mesh with your ideas about leadership and your culture and all that. It's imposed upon people, and the reaction is like it would be if somebody came to our country did it. The reaction is, you know, get out of here. You people are insane.
But I'm, you know, a lot of people are really on the people on the left, and progressive people and the anarchistic people and so on are suspicious of Obama. But I will just say that I'm an Obama supporter. I believe that he's doing the best he can with the structure that he has found himself, you know, burdened by and having to deal with. And I think that he's going to eventually, by the end of his, I hope, two terms, be the best president since Roosevelt.
You think so? I'm not going to disagree with you because I don't know enough about him, or probably care enough, because things seem to have evened out to the point where.
Well, you know, it matters who's president. A lot of people say, "Oh, they're all the same." Well, that's not true.
No, that's not true. I agree with you.
Obama's made some mistakes, like putting Ken Salazar in, which he did because he was worried about the economy. He was trying to keep the people in investment from freaking out. So he put in Ken Salazar in the Department of the Interior. But, you know, and he has been kind of like a little overly cautious in reforming Wall Street, although he is working on it. They are doing it. And the banking industry, they are doing it, but they're being moving kind of slow because they don't want to create another panic, and so he's trying to guide us into a recovery. But the guy has to deal with Congress, but he has gotten quite a bit done. It matters who's president. Like, for example, at the Food and Drug Administration, the Food and Drug Administration recently denounced a major pharmaceutical for a drug called Avandia, which is for diabetes, and it turns out this stuff kills you. And they said, no, this stuff kills you, and you guys have been lying about it. Well, if Bush were still president, or if McCain had been elected, they wouldn't say this. The FDA would not say it. They would not restrict it. They would not talk about this. They would anything for industry. you know, Obama, his EPA has been making rules about curtailing pollution and doing and taking big steps that that Bush never did. In fact, Bush took steps backward. It matters who's president, and you know, he, even though he can't do all that people hoped, he is making a difference. And slowly he's turning the ship of state, which is very big. He's slowly turning it in another direction.
What about the Gulf, the oil spill and the?
Well, he didn't spill it. BP
No. The reaction
And a culture that was like in the regulatory agencies in BP that was established under Bush, and they were supposed to be reforming it. But you know, the president's been working on the economy in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, he left it up to some people to do it, instead reform this stuff and see that everything is done safely from now on. But Ken Salazar and these other people didn't act proactively enough about it. And Obama then ends up slapping his forehead saying, I should not have trusted these guys.
Yeah, well, then the upshot is he ends up looking
like... What happened was, you know, established a long time ago. And it was all part of a pattern that was established a long time ago, long before the Obama administration. And he is like, the guy is not Aquaman, you know. He can't jump down and swim down there and plug up the hole, you know. And we actually don't have a lot of engineering that can do major operations a mile and more down. So
yes.
The only people who have that engineering, unfortunately, are the big oil companies. So he has to work through them. That's why it's such a big damn mess. And he's getting, you know, behind the scenes, he's very frustrated about it.
Right. Well, but the point I was trying to make is that the upshot of this, the public upshot of this, is that it's kind of a Katrina thing where not enough is done early enough. Whether it does any good or not, John, but the point is making the appearance that something is being
done. Good, but it's just that they're having to be, you know, BP tried to cover up, and then they... You know, and they were sluggish in responding, and their whole infrastructure for responding to this kind of emergency, almost non-existent. They lied.
Yes.
They lied to the Obama administration. They lied to everyone. BP lied about their capability for cleaning up a spill. They said, we can do this, 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 and this, but they never spent the money to do it.
Has he said
they
this publicly?
They lied about it.
Like you're saying.
And they were dishonest in their contracts with the United States.
Obviously, of course.
And
but...
so, and the administration basically, you know... they were just, we were, the EPA was just beginning to examine the, this industry closely when this happened. You know, they were just, Obama was talking about some new oil leases, but he said, but first we have to make sure of this, this, and this, and then this mess happened. And Obama actually, the day after the oil spill, we had thousands of ships, literally more than 1,000 ships on their way to the area. We had our response was actually instantaneous. The government response was instantaneous. It's just that there's a limit on what they can do because the problem is a mile under the ocean. But in the case of Bush and Katrina, they didn't do anything for a long time. And also they ignored warnings about the dikes. They were warned again and again that a hurricane would destroy those dikes and cause New Orleans to be flooded. And then he had an incompetent as the head of FEMA.
You could say that administrations before that had been warned as well, so it's not completely their fault. But it is their fault that they didn't react at all in time or at all. Well, I've got a friend that actually lives...
It was Clinton and Bush. Clinton was also too much in bed with big business and with too, and he was, like, you know, not concerned about environmental issues enough. And, you know, it's a... The Army Corps of Engineers has a long history of incompetence. That's another issue. But, Obama, you know, actually responded very quickly, but there was not that much they could do. And just now they're starting to really get organized to clean up the actual what has already been spilled. And that's because the equipment to do it was not in the area, and it was supposed to be, and it wasn't there. BP was supposed to have it.
Yeah, well, they said they did.
BP is also responsible for the mess at the Exxon Valdez oil spill because they were a partnership with Exxon, and they were supposed to deal with any spills that happen. And they said, okay, we'll have something ready to deal with any spills. But they didn't. And people don't realize that that famous oil spill in Alaska, also BP's fault that it got out of control. Not that it spilled, but that it was out of control.
Right.
And that it hit the land and destroyed all those animal life. If they had done their job, they could have contained it. I'm keeping you too long here.
Too long from what? No, it's fine. I do not determine what goes on this show. We basically just talk about what we want to or what the guest wants to, and that's fine. A lot of people may not know that you're interested in the work of Gurdjieff.
Gurdjieff or Gurdjieff, depending who you talk to.
Gurdjieff.
Some pronounce it Gurdjieff and some say Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff sounds too much like a sneeze to me, so. My teachers have always said Gurdjieff.
Why the interest?
I wrote a book about Gurdjieff called Gurdjieff, An Introduction to His Life and Ideas. Available from Penguin Books, and their Jeremy Tarcher imprint.
Oh.
And that's on Amazon and so forth. I'm interested in Gurdjieff. I'm interested in Buddhism. I'm interested in Vipassana.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in Taoism. I'm interested in Zen. And these things are all kind of radii from the same center for me.
Which is what? Freeing people so that they realize that they can function as a human being instead of as a robot or whatever.
Yeah, the cultivation of mindfulness. Now, you know, mindfulness is a big cliche in Hollywood now, and you know, it's like toyed with by people. It's very gotten to be a new age buzzword. People don't realize that there are many levels of it, and the Sufis had an art of understanding deeper and deeper levels and more refinement of energy fields within and around a person and sensing them. They made an art form out of it, really, or they super refined it, and especially schools like the Naqshbandi Sufis. So I actually made a short film called The Spiritual Journey, which has a lot of stuff about Sufism.
Huh, I didn't know that.
And it's a 25-minute film that is very professional, has really professional music. It has a professional voiceover and well shot, and somehow I've never got it on the air anywhere. It's probably partly because it's an awkward length. We speak on this film. We speak to witches, and we speak to the bishop of a Russian Orthodox Church where they have a mummy of a saint. And we speak to a Sufi in much depth, and we speak to a Gnostic priestess from the Ecclesia Gnostica in the Palo Alto area.
Yeah,
she's a pretty interesting person, Rosamund Miller. You can find her online. And we speak to Jay Kinney, who you might know from. He's been in the paranormal field, but also
former publisher
Gnosticism, and he wrote. He was the publisher of Gnosis magazine.
Yes, yeah, I wrote for Gnosis a couple of times, actually.
Yeah, that's right. So we interviewed all those people, and then worked it all together. And it deserves to be on the air somewhere. I don't know when that's going to happen, but.
You got somebody? Is that
maybe I'll put it? Eventually, I'll probably break down and put it online for a download.
Is that the one called Cognition Factor?
Called what?
What's the name of the documentary? Yeah,
The Spiritual Journey.
Oh, okay. Because there's something I
wrote the voiceover and did the interviews, and then Ted Oliphant, who's like an also an expert on cattle mutilation, by the way. He used to go investigate them when he was a cop.
Mm-hmm.
He filmed it and edited it together.
Wow, I didn't know you knew Ted that well. I guess I should have known, but I didn't know you worked on the film with him.
Yeah, we did, and it's actually a very professional piece of work. I showed it to a producer about 4 months ago. Who they're developing stuff for a new Oprah Winfrey channel, and he said it was very impressive, and of course we never heard from him again. He's also doing a show that's maybe a little too much like it or something. So it's supposed to have been the pilot of a TV show, you see.
Well, I hope
it gets
coming.
Contained, so well, I don't know. Somebody wants to see the spiritual journey for consideration somewhere. They can Google me, find my email at the John Shirley website and talk to me about it, or find me on Facebook or something.
Well, I'd like to see it.
I'm ready to make a move on it. And I didn't talk about Gurdjieff in it because we couldn't get enough footage that would be relevant. And we also spoke to Jacob Needleman, by the way, in it, who's like an expert in Gurdjieff, about other things.
Uh-huh.
And Needleman has a new book called What is God, which I recommend. I studied the Gurdjieff work and these other kind of related disciplines for 25 years, I guess. I meditate in a certain way, and I don't do any chanting or anything like that. It's only a form of mindfulness meditation.
Right. There's a good one that Alan Watts described in a lecture of gradually, and it's best done when it's quiet, but gradually getting to the point where all your sensory input is not connected to a conscious thought about what that thing might be. Like if you hear a bird, you think of it as a sound rather than a bird. And I've done this a few times, and it takes me about anywhere from 15 to minutes to an hour to get to that point. But the funny thing, as soon as I get to the point where all the things lose direct meaning, and I'm not making connection with them in my mind to a conscious image, as soon as that happens, that a satori or whatever it is kicks in, and unfortunately, like most people, I will give in to the amazement of it, and that kills it immediately.
Oh well, but you know, it leaves a little gift behind. It every moment of consciousness has value, and it's like
it's
a little sort of deposit in your bank.
Can you imagine people that can keep that going for more than a split second? And there are people that can do it. That to me is amazing.
It's also in Sufism and in the Gurdjieff work, they talk about something, you know, being, a person's being. You also get this impression from people like the Black Elk, for example. This sense that you developed a kind of inner substantiality of presence, and it becomes almost a substance. In fact, it does become a substance. And that enables you to sort of deal more and more with the higher consciousness, because you have, you have the film to develop a picture on, let's say. It's as if we were trying to develop a picture with only a tiny corner of film, you know, and it gives you more and more film to develop a picture on, let's say.
Also, what you're saying here sounds also like when you get to that level or get near it, you're starting to opt out of the validation game, you know, for your ego or whatever it might be, but validating.
You're starting to opt out of validation?
Out of the games, the validation game.
What do you mean by validation?
Validation meaning that, for example, I've gone through the pueblos in New Mexico and Navajo and Hopi areas and all that, the Southwest, and I got the impression after a while talking to a few people that simply being was okay.
Well, and of it course didn't, it's okay.
No, but the thing is that we are hypnotized into thinking.
Of course it is.
Yeah, but
then it depends on what you're goal is, you know. You can also develop, you may want to achieve a specific thing for a specific end.
Yeah.
You may want to, for example, survive death.
You think that's possible?
Something. Here's what I think. Something in everyone is a kind of little spark that watches everything that we do from inside us, and it is imperishable. But we don't identify with it. It's not what we think of as our soul. It doesn't have our personality. It just watches, you know, through us, and it's kind of like the universe's backdrop watching through us, you might say. The universe's consciousness, like substrate consciousness, ground of being, they call it in some places, and it doesn't die. But the more organized form of your mind and memory and so on will disintegrate. But it is said to be possible to develop a second body that can survive death and that takes this spark with it, and that goes on to other levels, supposedly, but you have to make efforts to do it. And so the Gurdjieff work is largely about, well, not largely, but it's directed toward that. Ultimately, that's the ultimate goal. I mean, you don't think about that all the time. You think about just being more conscious and being more present and these other processes they have. But, you know, ultimately is to create this second body. I have no way to prove that it exists. Don't know that it exists, in fact. I haven't verified it. I won't be able to verify something that specific until after I die. I sometimes think that one can verify that something is developing, but life after death, I don't know how to verify it. It's a hypothesis. So let's hypothesize that that's a possibility. And the Tibetans called it the body of light.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so, but it's sort of like, it's in the Bible, Jesus talks about casting seeds on the stones, right, and on the ground, and some fall on the fallow ground, and some on the fertile, some on the stones. And some of these seeds, you know, take root and grow, and others don't. And it just happens that the nature spreads a lot of seeds to get just a few survivors, in a way, in that particular realm, if this is true. Kind of like, you know, there's so many animals, like, you have, like, if you look at tadpoles, for example, you know, a frog has thousands of little babies, right?
Yep.
But how many of them grow up to be frogs? Most of them are eaten or die. A few become frogs. So it's, this body of light is something that nature intends for us, according to this theory. But most people don't get that far. But, you know, it's perfectly glorious to simply enjoy life while you're here and not aim for that. But a thing that I can't even prove exists anyway.
I was about to say, it's interesting to you hear you expressing these theories in light of the earlier stuff we were talking about and in light of other paranormal so-called phenomena. And
just theories, though. Just theories. Everything, yeah. You know, I have to have...
That's why I say you qualified it by saying this is a theory, but I would like to find out if this theory, which I have a good feeling about and seems to have decent evidence for it, I would like to find out if it's true, but there's no real way I can do that until I die, you know?
Well, you know, see, the thing is that this methodology has other effects in life that I can verify. So although I can't verify the creation of this being body, as they call it, I can verify that it makes me more capable of making conscious decisions. I'm capable of interacting people with less tendency to be impulsive in my reactions to them. I attribute it to helping me stop. When I was years ago, I had problems with drugs. It was intermittent. I was never really hardcore, but I was addicted to some drugs at different times, period. And I had trouble stopping. This helped me. And that's because it gave me a sort of inner leverage that I was able to use, and so on. It has a salutary effect in my life.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if I was able to verify this theoretical other result fit in the long term to me. It's to me, it can also be used as a sort of Zen approach. It's very close to Zen. It's just a little more hermetic in terms of, in the old sense.
It's a Western Hermetica. Zen.
The Hermetica, in the old sense of Hermeticism.
Yes.
It has some of those methods. It has it uses what we call inner alchemy. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I could sit Zazen too and be perfectly comfortable with it. And have done.
Yeah.
And Zazen is essentially just being there, mm-hmm. Really quite thoroughly as much as you can.
Sort of the thing I was describing earlier in a different way.
Yeah. At any rate, Alan Watts is somebody I respect a lot. So he's a guy, he was a very no-nonsense and he was not oriented toward the supernatural.
No, not at all.
If this being body exists, to me it is a natural thing, not supernatural.
Yeah.
Well, I don't believe in the supernatural.
Well, a supernatural is something that we haven't gotten adequate explanation for yet that satisfies most people.
That's what I think, yeah. That's what Gurdjieff said, too. He said it was the consequence of higher laws that we don't really understand, and that's an old idea. I mean, even the Theosophists said that. But if the supernatural, to the extent it exists, it's actually just an other natural, natural we don't understand.
Yeah, we're not conversant with yet.
I don't believe in magic or but there are things that are magical, and the miraculous happens, but it has a some kind of explanation that it may take us another 2,000 or 3,000 years of individual evolution to grasp.
You know what it sounds like? It sounds like what the definition of dark matter is. It has.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. There's the theory now that most 90-something percent of the matter in the universe is not visible. But the thing is, they can't see it, but it has the effects of matter. So that's what they have to call it. They don't know what it is or where to find it or how to see it, but it has all the effects of matter.
it is theoretical, too. I mean,
And it's theoretical.
It's sort of like they don't know how else to explain certain things, so they posited that. But
we've got these language problems.
People are arguing about whether or not it actually exists or whether or not they've, misinterpreted something and... at any rate, it is. Yeah, it's sort of like that. Most of the universe is still mysterious to us. We know vastly more than people 2,000 years ago, at least on some levels.
Yeah.
I really don't like it when people talk about the ancient societies as being deeply enlightened, and, I don't think so. I think there were some enlightened people back then. A Buddha was 2,500 years ago.
Yes.
But... really, most people in those days were believed that the Earth was flat and the Sun rotated around the Earth, and even the wise people of the time believed that evil spirits cause sickness.
Yes,
the ancient Egyptians believed that. So, I don't like to sentimentalize ancient peoples the way that New Age people do.
No, of course not.
This thing with the Mayans, oh, they're so wise. That's why they cut people's hearts out with stone knives in order to affect the weather, right? And, you know, nothing is going to happen in the year 2012 in particular that, you know, is, you know, I mean, it's not going to be any big epochal year in particular.
Well, I don't think so either. Actually, somebody asked me if I wanted to write a book on it, and I said no. They said, why not? And I said, because I don't think anything's going to happen.
Yeah, and then your book will quickly be outdated and ridiculous.
Yeah.
2012 would come pretty soon.
Yeah, it's coming
and
up quite well.
Some people went and found some, you know, descendants of the Mayas who still had, you know, some thread of Maya tradition and everything. And they said, no, that calendar didn't mean any such thing.
Yeah.
I said, I mean, no end of the world is coming. We don't have any such tradition of that coming. So forget it. But everybody just ignores that.
No, well, people like we talked about earlier, people like to believe, and more importantly, people like to be scared for some reason.
Yeah, well, they have to kind of exorcise their fear of death, I think, and then face it and then get through it. And look, I was dying, I was scared of dying, and look, I'm still here.
Yeah.
So it's like a little fantasy of surviving death.
A little fantasy of global near-death experience, right?
Yeah, no doubt. Global death. Anyway, this interview is going to perish now. It's going to go the way of all interviews. And
meaning we've run out of time.
We must bury it and take off our hats. Because my wife is giving me an odd look. I don't want to waste it.
Oh, the odd look. Well, then we should let you go then, John. Thanks so much.
Okay, so...
would you like to...
It's good to talk to you, and we'll do it again sometime if you want. And next time I'll interview you.
Okay, that's happened once before on this show. Actually, the interview.
I realize that you've got all kinds of secrets that you have, you know, and that you're not, you know, you don't feel good about divulging on the air, and I've got to pry them out of you.
Oh, I was going to say you're gonna pull the Howard Stern on me. As soon as I sound like I'm uncomfortable about something, you just start digging.
Yeah, works for me.
Fine.
All right, so
good.
That's what we'll do.
I'll look forward to it.
Radio,
it's a challenge.
Mysterioso.
Thanks so much, John, for coming on. Do you want to plug anything again before you go?
I would hope that if anybody hears this and is curious about my work, they would find my novel Bleak History by John Shirley, and if they're interested in Gurdjieff and they don't know much about it yet, they can. My book was written as an introduction, and it's available through Amazon.com. Just look up Gurdjieff and John Shirley on Amazon. It's
all
available
right.
In other places too, at esoteric bookstores and here and there. So, you know, Bleak History and my introduction to Gurdjieff, those are my plugs.
Enjoyed it as always. I hope you did, and tell Mickey thanks for giving you up for a couple hours.
All right, thank you.
All right, talk to you soon, John. Well, it was John Shirley, and did I expect that the interview would go about like that? I kind of did, because you can't really, with somebody like John, who I've known for quite a while, since I think the mid-90s, you can't really expect anything or guide anything, because he's got ideas about stuff. He's got specific ideas about stuff that he has thought through very carefully, which is rare. It's very rare. And I hope that everybody enjoyed it. We'll be back next week. And I don't even know who the guest is going to be or if we'll have a guest. Maybe it'll just be Walter and I. And if not, it'll be music. God, we haven't done that in a while, have we? It's Radio Mysterioso, and thanks for listening. Talk to you soon, or talk at you soon, which is more accurate. What can I play on here? Something that I've downloaded recently. Oh, you know what? This thing doesn't have the recent downloads list working. Nope, doesn't. Guess I'll have to play Messer Tubes. Oh, cockroaches. I thought we'd gotten rid of him in here. Anyway, Ready Mysterioso, thanks for listening. Agent Tremolo by the Mester Troops will play us out, and we'll see you next week.